you can start your day off right. When you find a professional on Angie to get your plumbing right first. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Visit Angie.com. You can do this when you Angie that.
Good morning and welcome to Morning Joe. It is Monday, May 3rd, which means it's Willie's birthday. Happy birthday, Willie. With us, we have White House reporter for the Associated Press, Jonathan Lemire, professor at Princeton University, Eddie Glaude Jr., founder of the conservative website The Bulwark, and author of How the Right Lost Its Mind, Charlie Sykes. We have a lot to talk to Charlie about this morning. And U.S. national editor at the Financial Times, Ed Luce, is with us as well. It's really good to have you all on this Monday morning. We'll get to former President Donald Trump continuing to perpetuate his big lie about the election fraud in a moment. But first, over 100 million Americans are now fully vaccinated from the coronavirus, and a major milestone for President Biden's COVID response. The U.S. reached the number on Friday, and the total U.S. population is now almost 30% fully vaccinated. Vaccine hesitancy remains a threat, though the country is really trying. It is a threat to the country's chances at achieving herd immunity, which is really what the United States needs in order to put the coronavirus behind us. A front page story in the New York Times says scientists believe the virus will, quote, likely become a manageable threat that will continue to circulate in the U.S. for years to come, still causing hospitalizations and deaths, but in much smaller numbers. All right. And we'll get to the issue with India, which is another story within itself, which does have ramifications here in the U.S. in just a moment. But first, former President Donald Trump continues to perpetuate his big lie about election fraud. He is still claiming it was stolen from him. Video surfaced of him addressing a crowd at Mar-a-Lago last Wednesday in which he talks about the Republican-led recount that is currently underway in Arizona's Maricopa County. He lost the county by more than 2 points, but told the crowd, quote, watch Arizona. Some very interesting things are happening. Take a look.
Let's see what they find. I wouldn't be surprised if they found thousands and thousands and thousands of votes. So we're going to watch that very closely. And after that, you'll watch Pennsylvania and you'll watch Georgia and you're going to watch Michigan and Wisconsin and you're watching New Hampshire. They found a lot of votes up in New Hampshire just now. You saw that?
Nope. Yeah, none of those states are in dispute. And I mean, while it's kind of pitiful to see him on patios at Mar-a-Lago, you know, just looping on all of this, there is a strain of this that is dangerously still alive, Joe.
Excuse me.
Bless you.
Dangerously still alive. Dangerously still alive. Charlie Sykes, you look at that video and it looks, it's pathetic and sad that a former president is going in the middle of receptions and just talking to random people.
And meandering around.
Lying to them. And lying to them based on what federal judges that he appointed said was actually the reality. But I read a Washington Post article this morning where somebody said, well, of course we believe him because Donald Trump has always been right. And we're going to get to what's happening with Mitt Romney a little bit later. We're going to get to what's happening with the Texas runoff a little bit later. But in every case, this party, as sad and pathetic and really just as stupid as he looks, the truth is there is an entire nation of Republicans that are blindly following this corrupt, just terrible man.
You know, it was pitiful, it was pathetic, and it was ludicrous. And I can't help thinking, look at that video and imagine that millions of people, including the leadership of the Republican Party, look at him and go, yes, that's our leader. That is our future. This is the man that we want to put back in the Oval Office. You know, it is this bizarre moment where the Republican Party looks at that picture and says, yeah, this is our guy. And anybody that breaks with him, whether it's Mitt Romney or Liz Cheney, we have to throw them out. And believing this lie has now become a litmus test in the Republican Party. It is now required that you do this. And the Republican Party is in the process of purging people that are willing to challenge the big lie and that are telling the truth about what happened. It's an extraordinary moment, Joe. And I say that having lived through the last 5 years of watching the derangement of the Republican Party and the acceleration of the derangement of the Republican Party.
You know, Charlie, though, we focus an awful lot, as we should, on the Kevin McCarthys and the others who know that Donald Trump is a joke and who will tell anybody that will listen to them off the record that they know that Donald Trump is a joke. But they have no choice. What are they going to do? If they want to be speaker, if they want to win their elections, they've got to follow Donald Trump. But what about all the people that we've known through the years? The rank and file people, our friends, our family members, party members, officials, people that helped get me elected, who claimed at one time to actually be conservatives, who actually claimed to believe at one time the same thing that you and I believe in, then small government. I feel like now's a great time to ask the question, what the hell has happened to them? And when do they leave? Is it the Nazi flag? Like when they carry the flag of the Third Reich around, do our friends go, well, you know, if you've ever looked at the flag closely, it does have a snappy design and nice colors. Anyway, at what point do they finally give up the ghost on this guy? Because we could go down the laundry list of things that he's done. We can talk about January the 6th. We can talk about the fact he was pressuring his attorney general to arrest, like a fascist thug, to arrest his political opponent and their family 2 weeks before the election. We could go down the laundry list of things that he's done that actually show that he is a fascist, and yet they keep following him.
Well, you know, the response would be, of course, is, well, what about Antifa? What about Black Lives Matter? Because this has become internalized on the right, just the willingness to look the other way. But, you know, and it's also interesting watching how with Donald Trump down there, you know, in Mar-a-Lago on the patio, the thought leadership, to the extent there is any thought leadership at all on the right, has shifted to people like Tucker Carlson, who don't even pretend any longer not to be pushing white nationalist sorts of narratives. And so this is the really ugly moment where you have 70% of Republicans who believe the election was stolen, and there's no indication that's going to change. And look, I would like to be able to say to you, Joe, that if there was really stronger leadership among the people that you have described, if more people spoke out about this, that maybe there would be this moment of recognition. But we've seen this again and again and again, where the acquiescence and the rationalization have just become the norm now on the Republican side. So yes, and it is getting worse. And my concern is that as these ideas become normalized, as the right shrugs off accusations of racism and white nationalism and fascism, that in fact our politics is going to be changing in extraordinarily ugly ways.
Yeah. And I mean, there have been times in the past few weeks where media outlets, all of them, have had on, and I'm talking about news media outlets, have had on Republicans who support the big lie and have tiptoed around it just because they're so grateful to have a Republican on to talk about other things. I'm sorry. I think that's wrong. The press needs to ask the question. And if they can't come on to have the question asked, and it's not a question being asked for Democrats, it's a question being asked for our democracy. Do you stand on the side of our democracy? And if they can't come on a news program, whether it's a Sunday show or Morning Joe or anywhere, to talk about that, I really don't know how you tiptoe around something like this. Look what happened to Republican Senator Mitt Romney of Utah, who was booed by delegates at a GOP, a Republican convention in his own state on Saturday.
There's a person who says what he thinks, and I don't hide the fact that I wasn't a fan of our last president's character issues. And I'm also no fan. aren't you embarrassed?
Senator Romney was the only Republican who voted to convict Trump in both of his impeachment trials, despite the reaction on Saturday. A vote to censure Romney failed shortly after that speech. Joe, I mean, Mitt Romney was dealing with it well enough as best as he could, but what these people are leering and booing at is what should be disturbing all Americans.
Well, he asked the right question. Aren't you embarrassed? You know, there's a guy whose father was Republican governor. There's a guy who was a senator. There's a guy who was the Republican nominee in 2012. I remember a lot of those same people booing those type of people eviscerated me in 2012 whenever I criticized Mitt Romney's campaign style and talked about how he was campaigning poorly and was going to probably lose the 2012 election. Mm-hmm. It was some of the most hateful screeds I've ever seen. But they're just tribal, you know, they're just in a tribe because now they're turning on Mitt Romney because he's actually done the right thing. He actually voted to impeach a guy who led an insurrection. But he asks again, he asks the right question. Aren't you embarrassed? Because, you know, maybe 25 years ago when I watched this tape, I would have felt really bad for Mitt Romney. But I know Mitt Romney. And Mitt Romney doesn't care. He's going
home. He doesn't need to be doing
this. To a wife who loves him. He's going home to children who love and respect him. He knows who he is. And so when they boo, they don't reveal the character of Mitt Romney. They reveal the character of themselves. And you hear that and hear people acting that way. And the question from anybody that's raised in a half-decent family is, like, what would these people's mom and dad think of them? Were they not raised any better than that? I mean, if they have faith in God, I'm sure most of those people there would claim to be Christians. Does Jesus not teach them better than to act that way? To be that rude to a man for doing something that they know they should all do, and that is condemn what's gone on over the past 4 or 5 years. Mitt Romney, you watch this tape. Don't feel sorry for Mitt. Mitt's fine. Mitt knows who he is. The problem, Eddie Glaude, is that those people that were booing in the audience and being extraordinarily disrespectful to a man who has given his public life to the Republican Party, these are the same people that booed a dying John McCain. Mm. These are the same people who booed a dying John McCain. And again, I ask the question, would their parents be proud of them? Are their parents proud of them? Are they? Listen, my parents were very conservative. Oh, my God, if I acted that way in public, was that disrespectful to a man or a woman who dedicated their lives to public service? I will tell you, going home to Pensacola, Florida, that would be an ugly scene when I walked through that door. My grandmom, whoo, if she were still alive, she'd take out a switch. I mean, it really, the lack of basic values and decency is really sad and shocking, considering that this is my tribe that is behaving this way. And there happens to be the added element, as Mika just said, of it being dangerous. Dangerous not only for the party, but dangerous for this republic when you look around and see that they're paying fealty to a man who utterly lacks character, utterly lacks compassion, lacks decency, and is the antithesis of every one of the Beatitudes.
You know, Joe, I think that's such an extraordinary point on so many different levels. You know, the question, aren't you embarrassed, presupposes that the folks who are booing actually have the capacity to be shamed. And one of the interesting things about our contemporary political moment is the absence of shame. Right? People are doing things. They tell lies, gaslight. They do whatever they want to do. They will hold one position in 1 minute, and the next minute they hold another position, right? So the absence of shame, right, has a direct impact, I believe, on the functioning of our democracy. And in so many ways, Donald Trump is an avatar of that absence. He has no sense of shame. He's never embarrassed by his behavior. And to echo Mika's point that you just referenced again, is that we could talk about Trump, we could talk about his impact on the Republican Party, but the broader question is, what are the impacts on our democracy? How is he in some ways extending what he's done since his campaign, since his presidency, and that is undermine the deep-seated trust in our democratic process, and he's still doing it. Of course, with no shame.
And Ed Luce, you look at what's happening here. It aligns far too closely. No, I'm not going to say Nazi Germany. We can just look at Hungary, modern day Hungary. We can look at modern day Poland. We can look at these states that have become illiberal democracies, in their own words, illiberal democracies. And we see that this is a trend for far-right, hyper-nationalist political organizations where truth doesn't matter, and mainstream candidates that have held these parties together as conservative coalitions, they have been, like Mitt Romney, they have been driven from the parties.
Yeah, they have. I mean, the Republicans after January the 6th and after January the 20th had a choice. Could they try to win back some of those suburban, college-educated voters who turned away from them, who used to be the bedrock, you know, incidentally, of Republican support? Or would they double down on the stolen election narrative? And they've doubled down on the stolen election narrative. They've given up hope of winning over part-time moderate Republicans. They've done a lot since then to further alienate that demographic. And they're doubling down on this idea of shrinking the electorate. Therefore, if you don't like the people, dissolve them and get a new one. And that is a classic hallmark of what the Viktor Orbans of this world are doing. You know, Biden's victory was, I think, a great blow for Western liberal democracy. It was a great event that stemmed some of the decline of liberal democracy we've been seeing in the last few years. But it's not the end of the story. The Republicans are getting worse. Next year, the French have a presidential election in which the far right under Marine Le Pen have a reasonable chance of winning. So we're still in a crisis here. And the direction, you know, watching Trump on that patio in Mar-a-Lago, at one level is very funny. It's like watching Barry Manilow, you know, do his great hits in Las Vegas. But on another level, it is deeply alarming that the party is following this man.
I would actually love to see Barry Manilow in Las Vegas, trying to get that film again. Mandy, I mean, you go down the list.
Oh, no, let's not digress.
I should have added no disrespect to Barry Manilow at all.
There you go.
Some of his.
Yes. No, that's quite okay. That's quite okay. We might say Milli Vanilli in Las Vegas. Oh, so Jonathan Lemire, there is, of course, a consequence to all of this. And we don't know what's going to happen in 20 lined up to have a very good run at it, especially in the House. Now, if they win, it'll be because of tactics, not an overarching strategy, and tactics can help them survive for the next 2 to 4 years. But you look at the arc of history here, and you see this political party falling in on itself, like the Whigs did, like the Know-Nothings did. And you start looking again, like we have over the past 4 years. You start looking at states like Georgia. You start looking at states like Arizona. They're about to overreach in Arizona and do something extraordinarily stupid in Arizona after three recounts, after one court after another said that Arizona was a clean recount. They're going to upset more suburban voters. So you take a state like Georgia, where Atlanta is too big to be overrun by Trump supporters in rural areas. Arizona's the same, with Phoenix being too large, where you have educated voters and suburban voters who are former Republicans, to be overrun by Trump supporters out in the country who may just not follow the truth or may just look at Facebook all day. And then we're going to be adding North Carolina to that list. That was close. But 4 years from now, with more educated people coming into North Carolina, you look at the patterns there. You're going to have a Republican Party that is going to start with Phoenix or with Arizona, with Georgia, with North Carolina out of their columns. Makes it almost impossible for these people to win. And yet, instead of trying to figure out how to reach out to the suburban voters of Atlanta, the suburban voters and intelligent voters in the research triangle in North Carolina, they're going the other direction. Like, they're the self-infliction of wounds. It just continues. And were I a Republican, my God, I would just say, this is preposterous. This is dangerous. Wake up. But they aren't waking up from this Trump nightmare that they've put themselves in.
Such a nightmare.
They are not. I'll start by wishing Mika a happy belated birthday, too. But this is the president, former president, still has a stranglehold on the party here, Joe. And it does seem like there may be a short-term window for success, but long-term, very perilous for the Republican Party. As much as they might like to think that some of the states that Trump put into their column in 2016 and Biden only won narrowly, that Michigan, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania trio, that maybe those are places where the Republican Party can grow in the future. It would be more than offset if they lose places, if that trio lose Georgia, Arizona, North Carolina, and more go to their out of their column forever. They are, though, it is clear, not willing to break from his spell. And they are doubling down on this big lie about election fraud, only cozying themselves up further to him. And we are seeing a litmus test. We're seeing Mitt Romney get booed. We're seeing Liz Cheney have her leadership position threatened with a clear signal that if you're not fully on board, there's not really a place for you in the what is now the mainstream of the Republican Party, which is the Trumpist part of the Republican Party that is still shaped in his image, whether or not he runs in 2024 or he doesn't. The chatter among people close to him is still that he probably won't, but no decision has been made. And they are talking about him being back on the road before too long, holding some rallies, perhaps, or some sort of speaking engagements over the summer. And the White House and Democrats are looking at this warily. They know history shows that the party that's not in power does well in the midterms. They are betting this could be an exception because they feel like the voting public will be turned off by the Republicans' loyalty to the big lie. And they believe that Biden will be successful with these massive programs delivering things into the hands and pockets of Americans that they want, and thinking that they'll, right before the midterms, have a real economic recovery, a real booming economy, which will also bode well. But Joe, I'll just close with a final point that I'm struck by the logistics of the setup at Mar-a-Lago. There's a microphone there every night for the president to just wander out and talk in. There's a house band that apparently is there every night anytime he wants to talk. Maybe it's two shows an evening, 5 and 9, sandwiched around dinner.
Tip your waiters.
That is so.
Tip just your waiters, my friends.
These are his customers. Yeah. That.
And boy, this is fearless leader right here that everybody is Oh my God!
So there's a band on
this
hand to like
leader.
What? Do ba dum bum? Like, I don't get it.
There always needs to be a band. Charlie, we'll close out this segment with you. You look at what happened in Utah with Mitt Romney. You look what happened in Texas with that primary where this very conservative Marine who actually talked like Republicans used to talk before Donald Trump became president. Ended up with like 3% of the vote. You look at what's happening in Wyoming, where Liz Cheney's political future is endangered. And there really are very few good signs. It leads me to wonder, could a guy that you saw and I saw from the time he was 25 growing up in public service, who eventually became Speaker of the House, Paul Ryan, could Paul Ryan be Speaker of the House right now for this Republican Party?
No chance. In fact, Ronald Reagan couldn't win a primary in the Republican Party these days. You know what's really extraordinary about the Liz Cheney and the Mitt Romney stories right now is look at their actual voting records. Liz Cheney is, she's not like us, Joe. She's not a squishy rhino. She has a plus 95% rating, I think, from conservative groups. She was a Trump loyalist up until January 6th. Mitt Romney's not voting for the Biden agenda. My point is here that these are Republicans that are very conservative, have been very consistent, and yet because of the one issue, the lack of loyalty, blind loyalty to Donald Trump, they're being cast out. So there is no other litmus test. It does not matter whether you have been a fiscal conservative, whether you have voted down the line with the Republican Party. This is the only thing that counts right now, whether you will buy the big lie, whether you will defend Donald Trump, whether you will look the other way for January 6th. And I don't see any indication that that's changing anytime soon.
Well, you know, my squishy former Republican friend, I had a 95% lifetime ACU rating. The other 5%, they just scored them wrong. And so it's so fascinating when I have people come up to me in the airports and say, oh, I liked you when you used to be a conservative. And I'm saying, so tell me ideologically, other than not supporting Donald Trump, what, name an issue I've changed on. And of course, they can't, because it's not about ideology. It's not about ideas. It's not about the things that have shaped Republican debates and have shaped conservative debates and have shaped debates in America over the past 240 years. It's nothing but tribalism and this personality cult. And Charlie, our party is had a lot of flaws, but could you ever imagine we would get to this point where, again, ideology didn't matter, a 95% lifetime rating didn't matter. Liz Cheney's 95% ACU rating didn't matter. It's all whether you support and are a member of this personality cult or not.
You know, and this personality cult, yes, I mean, it's extraordinary. I mean, having lived through it, it's still amazing watching the party become, I mean, you and I both remember when we thought the party, the Republicans were the party of ideas, forget that. It's become a cult of personality, but a cult of this personality, that guy on the porch at Mar-a-Lago with the open mic, that's the personality cult that this party has chosen. And they have rejected all of these other issues. All of the other leaders have been cast out. And that's really extraordinary. And I agree with Jonathan Lemire that, yeah, there's a possibility of short-term victory, but long-term, it's hard to imagine that this is sustainable.
You know, yeah, I completely agree. And we'll be talking more about this in a while. But by the way, if you are in or your family are in the Mar-a-Lago area over the next week, he will be performing every night, yeah. Singing. Well, he's going to do a lot of the hits from Rodgers and Hammerstein. I think he was doing Edelweiss. The repertoire is really pretty remarkable. And you
think
you
there might be it. Some space.
Two too. Shows, one at 5, early bird special, and one at 9 o'clock. Tip yeah. your waiters, tip your waitresses.
It's actually really, I mean, I think it's really sad. We were at the Capitol last week and walking around the empty Capitol and seeing the Capitol Police doing their jobs, but really kind of a pall had been cast over this quiet, empty building that was echoing. Yeah. And this was our United States Capitol.
Yeah, it really was heartbreaking.
It was hard not to cry.
Every time I go into the Capitol, I have such great memories and such a fondness.
Dead quiet in there.
Not just for that building, but more importantly for the men and women who work inside of it, and has long been for the men and women who work on both sides of it, on both sides of the aisle, who are trying to make this country better. Right now, there are about 175, 180 people who unfortunately aren't a part of that shared American experience. They're followed deliberately to undermine the Constitution. They try deliberately to ignore federal rulings from federal judges, many of whom were written by Trumpsters, and were actually decided by judges that were appointed by Donald Trump. And they just didn't like what the federal judges said or what the local officials said. So they tried to overturn the election results. So it was sad. But the Capitol Hill police officers, boy, you really felt for them. And they really need all of our support.
I felt for our country walking around that building.
Yeah, exactly. Hey, by the way, Mika, happy birthday this weekend. And Willie's birthday
today, yes,
is today.
Well, you were
hopefully
putting on your tie and jacket. I wished him a happy birthday.
Hopefully we will. Hopefully we will. Maybe we can get a call from the birthday boy this morning.
Well, he's quite busy.
He is very busy.
He has quite a party for his birthday.
Maybe just call in and we could.
Huge garden party.
Happy birthday.
Charlie Sykes, thank you very much. And still ahead on Morning Joe, a look at efforts to get America reopened as the Biden administration restricts travel to India amid the COVID surge there. And breaking news overnight at the southern border as the Biden administration works to right one of the Trump administration's biggest wrongs.
Today and every day, Planned Parenthood is committed to ensuring that everyone has the information and resources they need to make their own decisions about their bodies, including abortion care. Lawmakers who oppose abortion are attacking Planned Parenthood, which means affordable, high-quality, basic health care for more than 2 million people is at stake. The right to control our bodies and get the health care we need has been stolen from us. And now, politicians in nearly every state have introduced bills that would block people from getting the sexual and reproductive care they need. Planned Parenthood believes everyone deserves health care. It's a human right. That's why they fight every day to push for common sense policies that protect our right to control our own bodies and against policies that interfere with decisions between patients and their doctor. Planned Parenthood needs your support now more than ever. With supporters like you, we can reclaim our rights and protect and expand access to abortion care. Visit PlannedParenthood.org/future. That's PlannedParenthood.org/future.
35 past the hour. Back now to the fight against the coronavirus. As vaccinations rise and case numbers begin to plateau, statewide mask mandates vary across the country, with 24 states having no mandate at all. Some states have eased their mask mandates, but with certain caveats, such as in Colorado, Alabama, Georgia, and Arizona. They have the most aggressive reopening plan. Most businesses there are open at full capacity as caseloads are decreasing. Michigan, which now has a decreasing case rate after a troubling surge, has implemented a phased reopening plan. While most businesses are open with restrictions, entertainment venues still remain closed. Washington State and Oregon are seeing a spike in infections despite having an average vaccination rate. The new cases appear to be among younger people, most of whom are not yet vaccinated. Governors there are imposing restrictions to try and curb the spread. Oregon Governor Kate Brown imposed new social distancing requirements and capacity restrictions, as well as shutting down indoor dining. And Washington Governor Jay Inslee announced his state has entered its, quote, fourth wave, but did not change restrictions. Meanwhile, as India continues to battle a record-high COVID surge, President Biden will restrict travel from the country per guidance from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. A White House official tells NBC News the policy will not apply to American citizens, lawful permanent residents, or other exempted individuals, but these groups will still need to follow testing protocol for all international travelers. The situation in India is still extremely dire. On Sunday alone, the country announced nearly 3,700 deaths and over 390,000 new infections in 24 hours. Joining us now is Dr. Vin Gupta. He's a pulmonologist and an NBC News medical contributor.
Doctor, thanks so much for being with us. Let's sort through some of the things. First of all, just terrible things going on in India. Let's sort through some of the things going on in our own country right now. A hodgepodge of openings, reopenings across the United States. We've been told that if you've been vaccinated, you can go maskless outside. When your friends call you and ask you what's safe, what's not safe, what's your general guidance to them?
Good morning, Joe. My general guidance to them is to enjoy the things that they've long wanted to do, whether it's going out to eat, whether it's going to the ballpark. I've been advising a few clubs here about safe reopenings of larger events to do those things, but to just follow masking guidance when you're going to the concession stand, when you're closer to people where distancing is still yet not possible. But you can start to normalize your life, Joe. And which is a larger point here, that really to open up small and medium businesses, the question here is, how do we do that? How do we remove some of these onerous mitigation, burdensome mitigation initiatives that have been in place for 14 months? We can't do that without some form of vaccine verification. But it's impossible to continue to limit indoor capacity without having the ability to say, you know what, you're clear. No, you're not clear because you haven't gotten the vaccine. That is the quickest way to reopen. And we should be doing that more broadly. You're going to see the airline industry, the restaurant industry, probably professional sports teams move towards that path. And I think it's a smart path.
And also, when do we get to a point where, I mean, it's getting close now where if you want a vaccine, certainly in our state, if you want a vaccine, you can get a vaccine. At what point do we just open things up and those who don't have a vaccine and they choose not to have a vaccine have the freedom to not have that vaccine? Also, of course, have the freedom to get sick. It's just like people who...
Except they end up in our emergency rooms.
Well, just like people who smoke cigarettes. We don't go up to people and take cigarettes out of people's mouths when they're smoking cigarettes. At some point, people make choices and they have to deal with the consequences of their choices. We can't keep America closed down for those people who are too stubborn to get vaccines, can we?
Well, Joe, let me answer this way. What we don't want to do is enter a false sense of security where, say, we reach 60% coverage of the vaccine. Warmer weather, we know coronavirus doesn't like warmer weather. It likes cold, dry air. So we're going to be lulled into this false sense of security where maybe case rates remain low. We know hospitalizations are going to hopefully continue to decline, 80 to 85% capacity in most zip codes across the country. What we don't want, though, is that situation. False sense of security, because come fall, winter, that's when we can see a fourth wave across the country. So that's why it's really important that for all of you out there who are still considering getting the vaccine, I still think, Joe, most people are reachable when I talk to them, younger individuals. They just want to have a conversation. We really cannot say, well, let's put our hands up and 60% is okay. They are reachable. We just have to reach them better.
Well, and we can try to reach them better. I'm just saying, like, for instance, you talk about the fall. Every school, I think most parents would say every school better be open in the fall. When I drive past small businesses, whether it's in Washington, D.C. or Boston, and I see all these small businesses still closed, you just sit there and go, wait a second. We've got well over 100 million people with vaccines in their arms. Why can't we open up all of these places? People can wear masks. They can do social distancing. They can have ventilation in the stores, and we can stop every last small business owner from going bankrupt. I just think, you know, we've been talking about this for a year, and I've been very conservative with a small C. Follow the science. Follow guidance. Wear your mask. Do your social distancing. I still believe the same things. I just believe at this point, we also have mental health challenges. We have huge economic challenges for small business owners. Like, at what point do we reopen this country and follow those distancing guidelines and follow those mask guidelines when you're inside a building?
Mm-hmm. Well, and I'll say in response to that, the biggest issue, Joe, to normalcy is the distancing issue. Whether it's a restaurant or whether it's a small business that's selling retail, if you have how can we quickly off-ramp distancing measures? And the quickest way to do that is actually just to either mandate the proof of a vaccination or a negative test. We need to introduce friction into the system. If you've gotten a vaccine, restaurants, if they can verify one or the other, they can get to 100% capacity, Joe. That is the carrot here. And that's what small businesses need. They cannot continue distancing. That to me is the policy here that's killing small businesses. We need to get to 100% capacity for them to truly normalize the economy.
Jonathan Lemire with AP is with us and has a question for you. Jonathan.
Doctor, great to see you again this morning. I did want to shift our focus to India and what is just a cataclysmic situation there, a country seemingly on fire with this COVID outbreak. What are you seeing? If you, I know you're following this. What are you seeing in terms of trends there? Is there any signs of hope, or is things still getting worse? We know the U.S. government's sending vaccine supplies. There's an effort to get more vaccines into arms there, but it's an effort that is failing to this point. How dangerous the situation in India, and how bad could it be for the rest of the world if some new variants emerge?
Good morning, Jonathan. You know, this is an exceptionally dangerous situation, maybe the most dangerous situation we've seen in the last 15 months, certainly of my lifetime, from a health crisis standpoint. 1.2 million additional deaths are expected in India. 1.2 just in the next 3 months. And that's just what we know, Jonathan. They're measuring about 13,000 deaths, but potentially in the next 4 weeks. Again, what we know, some estimates say that we're not measuring. For every recorded death, there's 5 unrecorded deaths. You can do the math here. I mean, the numbers are cataclysmic. And in my view, what we're doing from a governmental support standpoint has been dwarfed by what the private sector is doing. More oxygen canisters have been coming from the private sector than from governments. We're talking about many fold more. They need hundreds, if not millions, of oxygen canisters to mitigate the immediate loss of life. Not vaccines. Vaccines is going to ultimately be what gets them out of it. But another key point here is they're not going to have enough vaccines for the rest of 2021. They have 2 approved vaccines now. Sputnik's on the way. They need Johnson & Johnson badly. That's still in the approvals process there in India. We need to lift the patent process so they can hopefully produce more vaccines in country. So that's going to be vital. But immediately, Jonathan, to stem the immediate loss of life, there's things that we can do. There's still things that we can do. There's something, I'm a part of this team. It's the CCAT capability, part of the U.S. Air Force. We should deploy that. It's a mobile ICU capability, typically used to move soldiers from Bagram back to Walter Reed, for example. But we have that capability. If we do so, it might set an example for other countries to do similar types of deployments of critical military assets. Obviously, the Modi government has to be willing to accept that. I hope they are. If they're watching, they should ask the Biden administration for that tactical resource. We need Regeneron and Eli Lilly to consider potentially donating therapeutics like subcutaneous monoclonals, again, in an experimental phase. But we're in a once-in-a-century crisis. Other companies are really stepping up as well. But this is the type of outside-the-box thinking that we really need here to mitigate immediate loss of life.
For more than a decade, Comcast has been committed to bridging the digital divide and connecting millions to affordable high-speed internet. But the barriers to get connected go well beyond affordability. Through Project Up, Comcast is committing $1 billion to reach millions with digital skills training, resources, and opportunities needed to succeed in a digital world. Project Up, building a future of unlimited possibilities. Learn more at comcast.com/projectup.
It is a terrible situation, Dr. Vin Gupta. Thank you so much for being with us. And Ed, you also talked about the dire situation in India, and we want to get you on this, but also on another issue. While the U.S. economy grew in the first months of 2021, I think we're on the path to over 6% GDP growth in 2021. The European economy is actually trending in the other direction. With COVID-19 outbreaks and lockdowns, the Eurozone GDP shrunk actually by 6% from January, 0.6% from January to March. This is in line with a similar drop at the end of 2020. After big gains last fall, Germany saw the largest decline, with the economy shrinking by 1.7%. France reported a small economic sort of uptick, but that doesn't take into account a national lockdown put into place at the end of March. Meanwhile, the U.S. economy saw its GDP grow by 1.6% over the same time period. You know, Ed, it's so fascinating. Through 2020, we saw one statistic after another where people would look at the statistics and go, my God, it seems like the Europeans are ahead of us on COVID prevention, on making all the right moves. Well, we seem to be stumbling along. Here we are in 2021. And it's a completely different story on vaccinations, on infections, and on the economy. What can you tell me? What is the difference between the United States and the struggles of the EU right now? What has made the difference over this past year?
So I think the key thing is vaccination rollout. The Europeans were quite late and bureaucratic in their procurement negotiations with the big vaccine companies. There was then the pausing of AstraZeneca and the dispute that's ongoing between the European Commission in Brussels and AstraZeneca over claims that it's not fulfilling its contracts. But the big picture is Europe's vaccination rate is at about a quarter of the level of the United States. And until they get that up to the levels we're now beginning to see in America and the levels that Britain's been achieving for a while now, European growth is going to remain stuck in the mud. And that's becoming quite an acute problem because Europeans do not give up their summers lightly. Last summer, Europeans essentially abandoned most COVID restrictions, went on vacation, gathered in big crowds, and we saw the seeding last summer of the second big wave that hit in the winter. There's no real sort of, there's no government that has the power to stop them doing the same thing again. It's just such a basic European right. So there have been some signs in the last few days that vaccine rates picked up. Last week, there were a couple of days when there were higher rates of vaccination in Europe than there were in America. Just one final point, though, about growth. If you look at the American very strong rebound that we're seeing, it's in parts of America. The map of America shows that vaccination rates are slowing in the red states, and infection rates are either not falling or in some cases rising in the red states. So we're not out of the woods yet in the United States. There is still a lot of vaccine hesitancy to overcome.
I agree.
Yeah. Hey, so
agree.
Ed, how much of a black eye has been the failed vaccination rollout for the EU in this post-Brexit world?
It's, you know, a kind of an unearned windfall for Boris Johnson. I mean, Britain's numbers are pretty dramatic. The last few days, they've had 12, 15 deaths a day. Only a few weeks ago, they were getting up to 1,000, 1,500 deaths a day. Rates of infection in Britain are about 2,000 a day. Again, they were well over 100,000 in January, February. That's a dramatic, it's dropped off a cliff because Britain's vaccinated people. It's a major victory for those who argued for Brexit. And their argument being that the European Union is bureaucratic, interfering, inefficient. Well, at precisely the time Brexit's happened, Europe's given a demonstration effect of that.
So why have they failed so miserably, Ed? Why has the EU failed so miserably on this extraordinary challenge that they knew was coming? Why did they fail on the vaccines? Why did they fail on not ordering enough? Why did they fail on not getting enough Europeans vaccinated?
So they ceded their negotiating power to Brussels. The European Commission is not a government. It doesn't respond like governments do to electorates. It doesn't have any experience of this. So they were pushing to get slightly cheaper vaccines. That dollar off the price meant a delay in the delivery because negotiations take time. They were trying to squeeze on price. And of course, every dollar saved on a vaccine, every week lost in its delivery, is hundreds of millions, if not billions of euros lost in economic activity. It's a totally false economy to try and squeeze on price when what you want is speed. And they sacrifice that. And I think it's a real teachable moment for Europe about the remoteness of Brussels from ordinary democratic signals that governments, the government of France, the government of Germany, they're no different to the government of Britain. They respond to electorates. Brussels is pretty shielded from democratic pressure. And I think that that's a large part of the reason why these vaccines are taking so long.
I mean, does anybody doubt, and I don't mean to beat this issue into the ground, but does anybody really doubt that if the Germans were negotiating for their own vaccinations, if the French were negotiating for their own, they would be in far better place right now. They would be, they would have been far more aggressive. They would have been far more intense in making sure that, yeah, they got a good deal, but that, that their people were going to be taken care of.
No, there's no doubt whatsoever. There is another sort of dimension to this, which is the European Union has been exporting vaccines to the developing world, to Africa, to India, to other parts of the world. They've exported roughly as many as they've put in European arms. So they're playing a very constructive role globally. Britain and America have over-ordered vaccines very sensibly. America probably has ordered about 300% of what it needs. But we're not exporting them yet. We're keeping them. We've got a sort of soft America first, Britain first approach there. I think, as Dr. Gupta was saying earlier, and as we're all aware, as this horrific catastrophe unfolds in India and has the potential to unfold in other parts of the world, we're going to need to take that leaf from Europe's book. We're going to need to export vaccines in our interest, not just for humanitarian reasons, but to protect ourselves. We're going to need to have, a global Marshall Plan to put vaccines in people's arms around the world. And that's one thing Europe has been doing correctly, but, you know, it should be vaccinating its own people as well.
Ed Luce, thank you very, very much.
You can start your day off right when you find a professional on Angie to get your plumbing right first. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Visit Angie.com. You can do this when you Angie that.